This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 Tuesday afternoon, April 16th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Technology has rewired children's brains, and those impacted are increasingly younger. We'll discuss that in our next segment. But right now, it was a big night for the Chicago Sky last night as the WNBA held its draft last evening. Let's discuss the impact on women's hoops in Chicago with sports director Josh Liss hanging around for a few more minutes this afternoon.
Howdy.
Now, there is the Caitlin Clark superstardom, which has consumed women's college basketball and now the WNBA. Is this a real turning point for the league, or does it have the potential to be a bubble?
Yeah, it depends on what point of view you're looking at. I think the Sky's two big draft picks, South Carolina center Camilla Cardosa and the uber popular Angel Reese, the 6'3 power forward out of LSU, big names, bigger talent, a couple of skyscrapers who are going to fit right in on the Sky in Chicago. Their net worth through NIL deals and the advertising that they do already is well over $1 million. But compared to Clark, she's well over $3 million in terms of a net worth right now. She's on all the ads. All the people want to see her. So the Sky got the two players that, you know, have beaten her each of the last two seasons.
And I will say that's part of the Caitlin Clark effect, because so many people tuned in to watch the women's NCAA tournament because of Clark. They got to know the competition as well. So the fact that they got the one player who went up against her and then one player who beat her, that probably makes it a bigger deal in Chicago than, say, if they managed to get Clark number one of the draft.
Yeah, interesting sort of way to look at bragging rights over Clark before they even play Caitlin Clark, which will come June 23rd and August 30th. The Sky season will start May 14th. They fit 10,000 into Wintrust Arena. They averaged just over 7,200 last year. As a comparison, that's about middle of the league in WNBA play. Las Vegas averages 9,500 fans, and Atlanta just about 3,000. So at 7,200 out of a 10,000 seat arena, Wintrust Arena, that they lease, they don't own the Sky, they could probably fill that up most of this season and maybe start some conversations. Will it be worth moving back to Rosemont, where they once played in a 17,000 seat for basketball capacity arena? There have been no conversations that I've been caught wind of them playing any games at the United Center, where they have 22,000 seats.
And this is also an interesting point in the evolution of the Sky as far as its public perception is concerned, because they're in a little bit of a rebuild. They got two big players, but they're only 3 years removed from a title. So it seems like the Sky is already in a better place as far as sports fans are concerned because of that halo effect from the title.
Absolutely.
So some of this is not entirely the Caitlin Clark effect.
Right. Yeah, Sky fans are aware that they're should be aware that they're under new management. It's not the same team and head coach that won the championship in 2021. They traded away their top player to get the number three pick. It was Kalia Copper. They traded away the MVP of that 2021 final. So yeah, under new management with a Hall of Fame coach, Teresa Weatherspoon, who coincidentally was a star at Louisiana Tech in the 1980s, Weatherspoon, under a coach and then assistant coach named Kim Mulkey, who would later coach Angel Reese at LSU. So there are interesting connections there. Weatherspoon is expected to lead the Sky team back into contention. Last year, they were 18-22 and lost in the first round of the playoffs.
And then very quickly, Josh, the Caitlin Clark effect just for the WNBA as a whole, they are coming up on renegotiating their TV rights, and it seems like this is a very good time for the league to cash in independent from the NBA.
Yeah, that's where a lot of these big leagues, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, are able to really afford these high salaries. It's through the TV deals and not just commitments from multimillionaires who own these teams and bankroll them, profit or not. So, TV rights deals would definitely, a multi-billion dollar TV rights deal would definitely take the WNBA, not just the Sky or Caitlin Clark's Indiana Fever, to the next level.
Josh List, sports director, thanks for breaking down the WNBA draft, what it means for the Sky and for the business of the WNBA. You'll hear him tomorrow morning.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
There appears to be no turning back from the technology that's playing an increasing role in our lives, including those of children. Let's talk about with kids and screen time with Jennifer Jolly, Tech Life columnist for USA Today, founder and editor-in-chief of Techish.com based in San Francisco. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today. And this is really a topic in which nobody has clean hands, because kids probably model behavior from their parents, who probably spend way too much time with their nose in a device, and it's just a never-ending cycle.
It really is. And as I say in my column that's out today in USA Today, we really have rewired kids' brains. And there's a new book out called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. I recommend everybody reads it and takes a long, hard look at how we have sort of turned our faces and minds away from, you know, that part in the horror movie where we're all yelling, "He's in the house, she's in, you know, the killer's in the house." We've taken a blind eye to that, and to the detriment of our kids.
Now, what are some of the ways in which just handing an iPad or a screen over to a child just to while away some of the time rewires their brain? Are we talking about just the instant dopamine hit that comes from just turning on an entertainment application? Or is it the call and response that comes from social media? Or is it both?
It's both. It's social media. It's addictive video games. It is the careful orchestration of these algorithms that have been trained to lure kids in and keep them coming back for more. And the youngest brains are completely powerless against it. Heck, our brains are powerless against it. So it's those factors. And then Haidt says it's those factors combined with the rise of fearful and overprotective parenting that really started in the 80s when I was growing up and continues to the present day, that's created this perfect storm. He says that we overprotected kids in the real world and underprotected them online. And I have seen so much of that around me. And I also have a 23-year-old daughter, so I've been the culprit of some of that overprotection as well.
Now, I'm going to say, I mean, for a lot of parents, maybe they think, I have been able to navigate these waters of smartphones and smart devices and social media for the last couple of decades, and I'm fine. I mean, in my own example, I mean, the iPhone was introduced when I was 27, and I signed up for Facebook at the hale and hearty age of 28. Now, my kids aren't on Facebook, but they do... No, they look at, you know,
that's where the old people are.
That's where I know, but I mean, they're not. They're not any social media applications, and it's going to stay that way for a while. But they do look at, you know, there's Disney Plus, there's Netflix, there's all these entertainment applications that have every form of entertainment known to man in the palm of their hand, literally. So how do you, as a parent, kind of reset that relationship?
Well, we have to create some new norms. And we have to, not only ourselves, but our neighborhoods, our friend groups, our family groups, we have to say no smartphones before high school, no social media until 16. Schools should ban phones during the entire school day, no matter what. And we need to give our kids more independence, freedom, and responsibility to play or hang out with each other on their own in the real world, just like many of us did when we were their age. Not all screen time is bad, but if the child is throwing a fit when the time is up, if it's passive versus active screen time, those are red flags. You have to pay attention to it. It is the most important parenting conversation of our generation.
Jennifer Jolly, Tech Life columnist for USA Today, founder and editor-in-chief of Techish.com based in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, find ways to find off-market real estate listings and avoid that bidding war.
Your daily transaction for useful information. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
For some prospective home buyers, finding a property that isn't officially on the market yet can be like hitting the jackpot. Let's learn about some of the ways to uncover such secrets. Spirits with Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, thank you for joining us today. And last week, we talked about the practice of just scrolling through those real estate apps like Zillow and Redfin, looking for homes that may be for sale nearby and just simply dream about possibly living inside one. But once they hit Zillow and Redfin, Drew, that means they've hit the MLS, the multiple listing service, which means that if you were to make an offer, you could be subject to a bidding war. But there is a way to find a home before it hits the MLS. So what's the best way to go about doing that? Like, should you just like knock on their door and say, hey, is your house for sale?
Thanks, Rob. That's an interesting question, because the answer to that would be, sure, that's an option. You can certainly, you know, look at that as an option. It's not common. But, you know, the houses that are off market, they are houses that are up for sale, but they're not on the MLS. And I think that some of the ways that people do that is, you know, finding an area that you want to live in. And then, you know, you can create a mass mailer and send that out to the, you know, homeowners in the area. You can also drive up and down these streets and look for homes that are, you know, for sale by owner. They're directly just they're not selling them with a realtor or anything. The other way I think that people are finding some of these off market is still connecting with the real estate professionals, because they are still plugged in. They've got all of these different resources that we, the public, don't have to touching some of these off market houses. So still contacting the realtors that specialize maybe in some of those off market price houses might be helpful too.
Now, if you go the off market route, I mean, the most obvious benefit is that you don't find yourself locked into a bidding war with multiple other potential buyers. But what are some of the downsides to going off grid?
Yeah, that's really the great question of all of this, because I think what happens a lot of times is it puts a lot of pressure on these brokers, because they've still got to get that same type of exposure that the MLS gives them without having it on the MLS. So they got to get these houses in front of enough buyers. Certainly a tough thing to do. And then you've got the issue of pricing. You know, who pays for what? Where does this go? You know, the sellers, they have to price it right, because it's not going to be a bidding war. And buyers are, you know, thinking, oh, hey, it's off market, I'm probably going to get a discount. You're probably not. You're probably going to pay a premium, because they can just go list this thing quickly on the MLS and get just a lot more exposure to more people.
And then, is this a practice that exists across the entire home price spectrum, or is this something you're more likely to see as prices are maybe in the high six figures, low seven figures?
Yeah, the real folks that are doing this are the houses that are in the seven figures, because they like the privacy. They don't want to have people walking through their homes. They don't want to have pictures of their houses all over the internet. And they like this conversation in the neighborhood about saying, hey, my house is on the off-listed market. So they don't have to worry about there's kind of a level of secrecy there that they like to discuss.
Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Travel Tuesday, making your next trip as part of a group.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Chicago teachers reveal their ask as they seek a new contract. Strong words from former President Trump on day two of jury selection at his hush money trial. It's Travel Tuesday, deciding whether a group trip is right for you. Also on the travel beat, taking along a pet on your next flight. Business, the markets are mixed right now. The Dow is up 39 points. The NASDAQ just turned negative, now down 27 points. The S&P 500 is down 14. 66 degrees right now under partly sunny skies in Chicago at 12:31. Topping our news at the half hour, Chicago teachers union leaders are announcing their contract demands as bargaining gets underway on a new deal. The deal that was forged in the 2019 strike is coming up. This is CTU President Stacey Davis-Gates.
Number one, you have to have a sustainable group of people who come into school communities every day. Right now, it's very difficult to be inside of these school communities. That's number one, because we don't have enough staffing.
Other issues include housing assistance and expanded dual language and fine arts programs. The union's existing contract is set to expire in June. The Trump hush money trial is in its second day in New York.
On his way into a New York courtroom, former President Trump railed against the judge.
We have a judge who shouldn't be on this case, He's totally conflicted.
Trump also complained over a gag order in the case. The case centers around payoffs to two women, including porn star Stormy Daniels. Trump is accused of falsifying internal business records and paying them as part of a scheme to bury stories about sexual encounters he says never happened. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
Hey, it's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are selling off right now. We're joined by Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk, based in Chicago. Michael, thank you for joining us today. And this is all happening in the last 10 minutes or so. The markets are all negative right now. What's going on?
Well, good afternoon, Rob, and thanks for having me on. Really, it's just usual volatility. We are seeing a little bit of a stronger sell-off here, in the, as you said, in the last 5 minutes or so. But really, it's just fears of bond yields continuing to tick higher. And, you know, you've got the 10-year and the 30-year both at 4.75%. And that is a level that it gets people a little bit concerned that we're going to 5%.
And actually, right now, it seems like the markets are engaged on the Jay Powell is speaking roller coaster. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is speaking right now. So we expect some volatility this afternoon. But it does lead me to my next question, Michael, and that is we do have some geopolitical tensions going on right now. Iran firing drones and missiles at Israel over the weekend, the world and the markets, too, waiting to see what happens next. And would a geopolitical event such as this qualify as kind of a stress test for market gains? And if so, how are the markets performing under that stress?
Well, I hate to say something as bad as a significant war in the Middle East is not important, but when it comes to the markets, it really is not. Obviously, to other things that are more important than stock markets, yes, it is very important. But when it comes to the stock market, you looked at where S&P futures opened Sunday evening, and they opened up and rallied higher. So that doesn't happen if the war is worrying the stock market. So what's worrying the stock market is yields. And as you said, Powell is talking right now, so we got added volatility. That even more speaks to the fact that yields are what's driving this market move, not geopolitical events. So we have to wait and see what the Fed's going to do in the near term. We think they're going to sit on their hands for a while because inflation data has just been too high. And that's caused long rates to tick up. And again, the market is sold off. But keep in mind, the market sold off 4% in the S&P, 4% in NASDAQ so far. So this is a very minor sell-off thus far, and it's still up significantly for the year. So we'll have to see. I mean, if we get rates to 5% in the long bond, you know, you're going to see the S&P under 5,000 and a more significant sell-off happening. But again, that's going to depend on current and future inflation data and then what the Fed will do in response to it.
And then we have earnings season still continuing, and some of the big banks are still reporting. And based on the data that has been released after the bell yesterday and through today, it seems like a mixed picture is emerging. I mean, United Health coming in above expectations, Johnson & Johnson mixed, Morgan Stanley beating analyst consensus, Bank of America coming in below.
Yeah, so you have had a mixed bag, but the overall picture is fairly strong. Even Bank of America, their earnings were hurt only because of being long treasuries, and they're forced to be long treasuries as collateral. And obviously, with yields rising, those treasuries have gone down in value. So most of the earnings have been good. The ones that haven't been have been at least it's kind of a decent explanation of why. And so we think S&P 500 earnings for 2024 is going to be 240, and that's probably on the high end of what most analysts expect. But it looks like a healthy picture for earnings, but you cannot have a bullish stock market when yields are rising rapidly. And so we have to wait and see. It's not an earnings picture problem. It's definitely a yields issue.
One index that we don't really talk about all that often on the noon business hour, but it is a good data point to bring in, especially during periods of volatility, is the VIX. And that is kind of the fear gauge for the markets. And what is that telling us right now? And how does that put today's numbers into perspective?
I mean, the VIX has remained fairly fairly calm during this entire situation. In fact, it's down again today to 18. I mean, 18 and change. That is on the low end of you know, where it can trade. I mean, it's ticked up in April, but again, April's been very volatile. I mean, really, you don't start getting worried about the VIX until it ticks over 20. Could it happen? Yeah. I mean, if yields continue to rise, yeah, you'll have a VIX over 20 and you'll have more volatility. But so far, this small move up in the VIX is not concerning to us. It just basically speaks to the fact that people are getting a little bit nervous about yields. So we just have to see what the inflation data is coming up, and will things stay? Will the long bond stay below 5%? That's the big number, because above 5% in the 10 and 30, you're going to have the S&P selling off well below 5,000. But we'll have to wait and see.
Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday for planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Hey, it's Travel Tuesday. In this segment, we're examining the option of taking a group trip. Let's get some help from Angie Rice, co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors based in Scottsdale, Arizona. Find her online, travelbta.com. Angie, thank you for joining us today. And all sorts of groups can go on group travel, but who do you think it benefits the most?
Right. First of all, it really isn't that one group is going to be more advantageous as far as, are we marketing to women? Are we marketing to families that want to travel together? Or is this a group of, you know, young, you know, is it by, you know, age, demographic, luxury travelers versus adventure travelers? But the key is that you choose a group, if you're joining an existing group, that really aligns with your interests, as well as, you know, sort of your plan of agenda and the destination that appeals to you.
And then when we're talking about a group trip, I mean, sometimes is it a group of people who know each other, or is it a group of people who they don't know each other, but they all have common interests, whether it's life experiences or the destination?
It's really 50-50 from the standpoint of putting together a private group. We have just as much when a group comes to us. For example, I have a women's group where the leader of this women group called us up and said, I have, you know, a divorcee group, and everyone's top interest is not so much meeting for coffee. We want to travel together. So that's an existing group, and we've, you know, agreed to meet them quarterly to do some webinars to really inspire this group of women on different trips that they might want to take together. It's a growing divorcee group, so not everyone's going to take a group together. They're going to pick and choose based on what's of interest to them, but that's kind of a closed community, and that's a lot of fun. Other times we have, for example, a travel advisor, Julie Rose, and she kind of is a little bit of an influencer on social media, and she onboards travelers that travel solo. Sometimes she does co-ed groups. Sometimes she does specifically women's groups. And they're meeting for the first time, and they're solo travelers that really want to socialize, meet other people. And the dynamics change depending on the group and the destination and the appeal of where they're traveling.
And do you find that these common life experiences, that's who's booking the trip? You're talking about like a group of divorcees. But how about seniors or maybe widows or widowers or people who are single? Is that really kind of the secret to bringing a disparate group of people together, is that one common experience?
You're definitely going to see some trends. For example, we see a lot of women traveling in groups together when maybe the wife is no longer working and the husband is still working. So they're not single, but they're single from the perspective of they're traveling alone. And in other situations, we do have kind of, you know, that the seniors have more time to travel. So there's a higher concentration of travelers that fall into that category, similarly with college students, because they have more time off to travel than people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s that are more career-oriented. But I will say that there isn't necessarily an inability to travel in a group because you're traveling with a family. So we do see the married couples traveling together as a group. We see families traveling together because there's definitely economies of scale when you travel as a group, because you need one guide to maybe tour with two or three families, versus if those families were traveling alone, they'd each be paying for that guide. Separately, why I personally find groups to be very, very appealing. I recently was on a Backroads group tour, which was focused on the El Camino Trail in Spain and Portugal. And I really liked it because when you're part of a group, it really elevates the experience because you have more behind the scenes type experiences. So while we were on the El Camino Trail, we were meeting with Portugal families, touring the estates, having dinner and lunch in their homes, picnic lunches set up for us. That's something, if my husband and I and the kids were traveling by ourselves, we couldn't finesse that. But because you have a group and we're pooling our resources together, there's more financial means for the group coordinator to be able to invest in some of these a little bit more elevated experiences. And keep in mind, you can travel in a group. There's itineraries for land. There's itineraries for river cruising and ocean cruising. And putting together the group with a travel advisor allows us to help you put your group together and make sure that the itinerary appeals to everybody. So there's a lot of options in group travel. And by all means, I don't necessarily think you're going to want to travel in a group every time you take a trip, but I find it to be very appealing.
Angie Rice, co-founder, Boutique Travel Advisors in Scottsdale, Arizona. Find her online, travelbta.com.
Discussing the news affecting your money, the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Travel Tuesday continues, and surveys signal that a growing number of people are taking their pets with them on airline flights. Let's discuss the ins and outs with Melaine Rodriguez, client service manager with Viagen Pets in Austin, Texas. And Melaine, you've been on the show before because we talked about your business, which is the business that uses a sample from your pet to create a clone after that pet becomes a dearly departed family member. And so you would know a thing or two about traveling with pets because you have to fly across the country to deliver the finished product to their new owner.
That's exactly right. I do a lot of the deliveries of our cloned puppies and kittens to clients across the U.S. and even some international clients.
Now, what is the secret to success to traveling with a pet? I mean, first off, what are the general, airline rules of thumb for traveling with a pet above and beyond those viral stories about passengers getting kicked off because they can't bring their, emotional support crocodile with them?
Right. So all of the airlines will have your standard rules of the pet has to stay in an airline approved pet carrier that has to be the correct size to fit under the seat in front of you where your feet would go. And the pet has to have enough room to stand up and turn around. So it can't be a big, huge German Shepherd trapped in a small little carrier. They have to be small enough of a pet to have plenty of room inside that carrier during the trip.
Now, do you find because you are transporting puppies and kittens that you don't run into those size limitation issues?
Most of the time I don't. I have delivered some 8 and 9 week old German Shepherds that even at that age, they're pretty much taking up that whole carrier, but they do have enough room to stand up and turn around. So usually those are short flights and the puppies do just great, even though they're a little bit cramped in there.
Now, what happens if you cannot fit the pet inside an airline-approved cabin carrier? Does that mean you're driving, or is there some other is there a workaround?
Right. So, yeah, we have had some dogs like, the big giant breeds of dogs that at 8 weeks old are just too big to fit in the cabin of a plane safely and comfortably in a pet carrier. So in those situations, the pet would be transported by vehicle. So we never recommend cargo transfer of those pets. So we would hand deliver those pets driving in a car. So that's something that I've done as well. I've delivered a giant breed of dog cross country.
And then what are some of the rules regarding having a pet in the cabin in an approved carrier, but for international travel? Because then you're running into a lot of really thorny customs issues.
That's exactly right. So they have to have all their paperwork in order, and that really varies by country. But most countries will require some sort of health certificate that's endorsed by the USDA. Europe requires that the pet be vaccinated. So for our European clients, the puppy has to have a rabies vaccination, which is done at about 12 weeks of age. And then there's a three-week wait time between that rabies vaccination and when they can enter the country. So those puppies are usually around 15 weeks old before they can travel internationally. Most airlines will allow the pet to travel in the cabin. Some airlines don't for international travel. So we haven't been involved in any of those. All the airlines and places that we've gone have allowed the pet to be in cabin. And I've been really lucky. I've delivered a puppy to the Netherlands recently, and that was a wonderful little puppy that did great on that long flight.
Milene Rodriguez, Client Service Manager, Viagen Pets in Austin, Texas. Thank you for joining us today.